Hello, welcome to Here and Now, the Dawlish and Tynmouth area talking newspaper. Today's date is Friday the 16th of February 2024. I'm Mo Hutchings, leader of the Blue Team. So, let's meet our first readers.
Hello, I'm Nev Pope.
Good morning, this is Norma Orty.
Welcome, Nev and Norma. So, first article is the headline from the Dawlish Gazette, which I will forewarn you now is also the headline article from the Tynmouth one when we get to it, so we'll cut that out later. Headline is, Let There Be Lights, or in this case, not. Tynmouth could remain a dimmer place as there is no money to fund replacements for its decorative seafront lights. Teignbridge Council, which is responsible for the lighting, says there is no money to replace the illuminations, and cash constraints means its budget has to be spent on priority services. The Town Council has been calling for action over the lighting and has responded to continuous speculation after the decorative lights were removed from the seafront and the den. Town councillors have been blamed for the situation, comments which the Town Council says have been fuelled by incomplete or inaccurate information. Now, Town Clerk Ian Wedlake and Mayor Councillor Joan Atkins want to put the record straight over which authority is responsible. In a joint statement, they said councillors are regularly quizzed about why this situation exists and what the council is going to do about it, and are less than pleased when told this is all in the hands of Teignbridge Council, who are still unresponsive to requests to replace the lighting, not just in terms of decoration, but in terms of public safety. But a spokesman for Teignbridge Council said, given our current budget shortfall of £2.4 million, we simply can't provide some of the things we've previously been able to, having instead to prioritise the services that meet the most critical need, as well as key services like waste collection. The situation has come about after one of the lampposts on the Upper Den carriageway sheared off in 2021. These lampposts are the responsibility of Devon County Council. Gets more and more complicated, doesn't it? Their highways department, who came to inspect the extent of the problem. On detailed inspection, it was discovered that numbers of other columns were at imminent risk, and the County Council made the decision to replace them entirely. Unfortunately, because the lampposts carry the decorative lighting, which is Teignbridge Council owned, the lighting festoons had to be removed, and the District Council put them into store. After consultation with Tynmouth Town Council on limited range of designs for the replacement columns, limited due to the time constraints of replacement, Devon County Council opted for those that are now in place. However, these don't have sufficient wind loading for the decorative festoon lights to be reinstalled or replaced. Mr. Wedlake explained, that has left us without decorative lighting on the seafront since Teignbridge Council has been unable to fund any replacement. However, Devon County Council, while replacing the columns, in consultation with the Town Council, provided a power source on each column, which will carry both a CCTV camera and has provision for a decorative lighting feature. The Town Council is in the process of re-providing the CCTV, but Teignbridge Council has indicated there is still no funding for replacing any lighting, including decorative features. While the replacement process was being undertaken by Devon County, it was noticed one or more of the Teignbridge Council lighting columns for the decorative lighting across the den were also in a dangerous condition. Mr. Wedlake says following this discovery, Teignbridge Council cut all the columns down, and despite repeated requests from the Town Council and others, there is no indication they are going to be replaced. If ever there was reason to have a unitary authority, that article has got to be it. Right, over to Nev for her first article.
Well, this article shows has three photos, and the backdrop is recognising outstanding people. And seven police officers have been praised for saving the life of a woman from the sea at Dawlish. The group of officers were recognised for their efforts by going into the water to save the life of a 25-year-old woman who was in a suicidal state. PC Hayley Kalis, Dan Jenkins, Jeffries Matthews, George Miller, Darius Pogorzelic, Sergeant Mark Smith and another officer attended a call during the early hours of the morning in April 2023, following reports a woman had entered the sea and was about 50 metres away from the shore. Although HM Coast Guard had also been alerted, there was no idea when they would arrive. So the officers on the scene knew they had to act immediately, as the woman was in danger of going underwater or being pulled out further to sea. In an effort to reach her, they tied two 25-metre throw ropes together. With one end tied around his waist, Sergeant Smith entered the water while his colleagues held the other end back at shore. It became clear the woman was further out than first thought, meaning PCs Kalis, Jenkins and Miller also had to enter the sea with the rope to allow Sergeant Smith to wade further out. Sergeant Smith eventually managed to reach the woman, who appeared to be struggling to keep afloat, and the pair were then carefully pulled in by the team back to shore. Following the incident, the woman received support from the police, ambulance and the NHS services. A police spokesman said, without the quick thinking, bravery and teamwork of the officers, the outcome may have been very different. PC Miller said, decisive leadership from PC Smith and strong teamwork and communication from officers in attendance meant we were able to prevent the incident escalating and serious harm coming to the woman. We routinely put ourselves in difficult and sometimes dangerous situations, but gladly do this in the hope that we make a difference to individuals, families, and the wider communities in Devon and Cornwall. Nearly 30 officers were honoured for their commitment and dedication to their roles at a recent awards evening held by Devon and Cornwall Police. Chief Superintendent Roy Linden, who heads up the policing teams in South Devon, said, "It's been a privilege to celebrate and acknowledge the exceptional work of our officers in South Devon. It's truly inspiring to hear the accounts of how officers and staff have gone over and above their roles to keep people in our neighbourhood safe, whether going face to face with danger to save lives or going the extra mile to serve their communities. Our officers and staff have acted with care, courage and dedication."
Our next story is also about a rescue, but on a slightly different level. Two town councillors came to the rescue when a cygnet was in danger of being washed away in Dawlish. The alarm was raised by a member of the public reporting one of the cygnets was stranded on the wrong side of the viaduct and could have been washed out to sea. It had headed that way as the other pair of nesting swans had bullied and pushed it out of the way. Councillors Alan Pine and Hugh Weatherhead leapt into action. A council spokesman said, "They donned their wader boots and carried out a cygnet rescue on the lawn. It was not what they were expecting to do that evening when they were attending the council meeting. After successfully placing the cygnet on the lawn, they returned to the council meeting. All the four cygnets are now moved to the aviary as a temporary measure to get used to the surrounding upstream from Tuck's plot, where they have been before being hopefully let out again further up on the brook area. Meanwhile, part of the footpath along the brook remains closed as the breeding pair Bert and Kimber began laying in a clump of pampas grass. Several eggs have been laid there, and the Dawlish waterfowl wardens have set up barriers around the site as a precaution to protect the birds. Warning signs are up asking people not to feed the birds while they are nesting. The wardens have tried to get them to nest elsewhere, specifically the specially created nesting area at Tuck's plot, which is raised to protect from high water, but they are determined to stay just where they are.
Wow, seawall footpath ready for treading. Repairs have been completed to sections of the seawall at Dawlish, damaged by Storm Ciarán. And I was only there the other day and I had noticed and I felt that it had been repaired quite quickly. The section between Coast Guards and Red Rock Langston has now reopened this week. Engineering teams had replaced or repaired 32 coping stones. These are the large stones along the edge of the wall and they can weigh around 2.5 tonnes each. A number of these were on the Tynmouth side of the seawall, where the damaged section between Smuggler's Cove and Spray Point was reopened late last year. But Dawlish walkers enjoyed seeing the repair work on their regular Monday wellbeing walk along the seawall. This section was along the Part C wall, which is the original section, and it's showing photographs before and after, and I can actually put my personal point through that they've been repaired, and I am so glad to have seen them repaired.
Good. This article concerns the railmen scaling the heights, and having a son and a grandson who are rock climbers, I can appreciate what they're doing. Engineers with a head for heights are carrying on with the work to stabilise the cliffs above Dawlish railway line. Efforts are continuing along a 1 kilometre stretch of the line, with work, which started in July last year, expected to finish in the spring. Vegetation along the cliffs has been removed to allow for the resilience measures to be installed. Network Rail has been working with Natural England on part of the site which fall within the Dawlish Cliffs Site of Special Scientific Interest, SSSI. Coir matting is being installed, followed by 19,700 square metres of stainless steel netting, secured by 5,260 soil nails drilled to depths of up to 12 metres into the face of the cliff. And the picture shows 8 men hanging on ropes over the cliff face.
Wow, a £13 million care home in Dawlish is hosting an open day ahead of its official launch. Claremont Manor, a 71-bed care home, will offer residential, dementia and nursing care when it opens in March. And I've been watching this being built over the last few months, and it's actually opposite Sainsbury's as you are on the road from Dawlish to what I call a coast road to Exeter. But ahead of the home opening next month, members of the local community are invited to experience a preview of everything it will offer at an open day on Saturday, February the 24th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. The team will welcome visitors with activities and entertainment, home tours and food from the home chef. Facilities at the home, part of the Maria Malaband Care Group, which has already got 80 homes nationally, will include a hair and beauty salon, a cinema room, a wellness suite, private dining and leisure suite, and a grandchildren's room for families to gather. Carla Bowman, Senior Operations Manager at MMCG, said, "This is such an exciting time for all of us at MMCG, especially the new team who will take this home forward. We can't wait to share this exceptional home with the Dawlish community, and I for one will go and have a look round." For those moving in next month, it will be the beginning of an exciting new chapter. We want to create a vibrant, happy community where people feel they belong, be themselves, and continue to love life and live it to the fullest. The new lifestyle team will begin by getting to know everyone living with them, creating a personalised lifestyle plan for each, capturing their likes and dislikes, hobbies and interests, and the activities they would like to try or continue with. Among a varied programme will be Just Bowl indoor bowls, movement exercise sessions, and an online resource created for the care sector, offering a choice of live and recorded exercise sessions, virtual tours, language lessons, history talks, music concerts, interactive quizzes, and more. The owners aim to bring wider benefits and become part of the community, and has already begun working with the Strand Centre Food Bank. Carla added, "I'm happy to say we've received the warmest of welcomes and a huge amount of interest already. This will be an exceptional place to live and work, and we are so excited to see it come to life and become an integral and valued part of this fantastic community."
Sounds exciting. Unfortunately, I'll be away next week. A Dawlish community charity has been granted £60,000 by the lottery to help its services in the area for the next 3 years. Roots Community Enhancement is now in its 6th year of operation and helps almost 200 people in Dawlish and the surrounding areas every month. Now it has been awarded the cash from the National Lottery Community Fund to support its work. The charity is being funded for its Thinkers Anxiety Cafe, baby massage courses, hatchlings feeding support groups, and the Coastal Carers Club. The Waves Bereavement Group, Children's Group Signets, for up to 18-month-old babies, which includes a weighing service, and Tempo Tots singing and craft group for up to 4-year-olds will also benefit from the funding. Run predominantly by volunteers, the charity's work directly helps several hundred people every month in Dawlish itself, as well as Tynmouth and local villages. Charity Director Rosie Dawson, who is also Mayor of Dawlish, said, "We are absolutely thrilled to be able to continue working with locals on community connection, mental well-being, and living with life changes. We get such lovely feedback from people who are our groups." So it's wonderful the lottery funding panel have agreed to support us again. One of its efforts involved helping a family which had recently come to Tainbridge area from war-torn Ukraine. A teenager who wishes to remain anonymous had a dream to own a guitar. Rosie got in touch with Gar Chatterton of Gaz Music Solutions, which opened in Dawlish last year. Gaz got in touch with his friend and fellow musician Roger Hellyar about the importance of music and creativity in teenagers. Their conversations prompted Roger to donate a brand new guitar to the teenager, who is now enjoying making music. Comments by one person who uses the charity's anxiety support group has said it has been life-changing. They said meeting others and becoming part of a supportive community of people who understand me and the challenges I have. The organisation was set up to provide services and groups to individuals in and around Dawlish with the aim of improving lives. Thank you.
Now, although we've had some fairly mild weather for this time of year, apparently there's going to be a cold snap coming ahead. And so this article says, warm kits keep winter chills at bay. 100 warm bags to keep winter chills at bay are being distributed to people in and around Exminster as a result of a partnership between Western Wales Utilities and Exminster-based charity Westbank Community Health and Care. The bags are being distributed to people in the local community through Westbank's recently launched Warmwell at Home initiative. Each bag contains hand warmers, a thermometer, a pair of thermal socks, a travel mug, a hat and gloves, a hot water bottle and a large blanket. Western Wales and West Utilities, the Gas Emergency and Pipeline Service, initially donated 150 thermal hats and gloves before Christmas, and they were distributed through Westbank's Food Larders and Warm Space initiative. Now, they're continuing to help keep people cosy by donating 100 warm bags for Westbank to distribute to clients. National Grid has provided the funding to allow the charity to buy additional heavyweight blankets and is covering the distribution costs. Westbank is working in collaboration with community support workers, GP and health practitioners, and local primary schools to identify those who would benefit most from the extra support as temperatures drop. Katie Elliott, Head of Fundraising and Marketing at Westbank, said, "We're delighted to get our new Warmwell at Home initiative up and running in a short period of time and are already helping many local people. We're thrilled that Wales and West Utilities has extended its support so that we can provide extra help to those most in need during the colder months." Warmwell at Home is run from the Howarth Room at the charities based in Exminster and is open Monday to Friday from 10 till 4. The Warm Space has a lounge and dining area where people can help themselves to a free bowl of nourishing soup and a hot drink and stock up on produce from the food larder and community fridge. Louise Alfresi, Wales and West Utilities first line manager for Exeter, is responsible for establishing the partnership. She said, "We know how much difference the hats and gloves made to local people. So when we learned of the Warmwell at Home launch, we wanted to provide extra support, particularly with the recent cold weather. The Warmwell initiative provides a safe and warm space for people to drop in for as long as they want, and we hope the warm bags extend the reach of the service by helping people keep warm in their own homes."
This next piece is called In My View, and it is in the view of the Tamebridge leader, Councillor Martin Wrigley. Clearly, it is an election year. Last week, we had a visit to the region from the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. His appearance on local TV news and radio from Plymouth was apparently to highlight the lack of NHS dentists in Devon. Sadly, he doesn't realise that the problem with the NHS dentistry is simply that the government contract simply does not pay enough to do work, and dentists cannot afford to lose money on every patient. Is it that the PM wanted to come and visit to reduce the image of a government that is out of touch with the country and the country, county and the country? I was asked to suggest the key things that Tamebridge needs from central government. The top three I listed were more affordable homes, stopping the sewage pollution of our rivers and the sea, and fixing the potholes by having a fully funded maintenance programme. The interview turned into a difference of opinions between the Conservative leader of Devon County Council and his Prime Minister. Rishi said that Devon had 9 million extra last year for potholes, and John Hart said that 7 million of that had been swallowed up by inflation. In either case, the money was a drop in the ocean compared to the local need. Rishi Sunak went on to promise one-off funding from his cancellation of HS2, but failed to understand that council budgets and plans work on an annual basis, and gearing up to spend on a large contract needs to be planned to be effective. We also heard last week that Rishi Sunak's income last year was taxed at a mere 23%, much less than most of us. It was also clear that being Prime Minister wasn't his main income, merely his side hustle. It is clear that the PM has no concept of many people's lives in Devon today. The issues of trying to find a home to rent, of being concerned for how companies are polluting our areas for their profit, and of not being able to drive to work or school without having to play Miss the Pothole, are far from the world of a multimillionaire. Meanwhile, the dentistry profession appears to be suggesting that the government's meagre changes to the NHS contracts won't help. Local Conservatives say that government is failing the county on potholes, and water companies are still laughing all the way to the bank. With the government out of touch and a general election expected in the autumn or sooner, I expect we will start to see our local MPs once again making the rounds.
Right, this is a load of ongoing road closures, and I have to confess I've never sort of read it before. So one of the things I'm going to mention before I read them is that it gives dates, and all of them say from a maximum of 18 months. So they're really hedging their bets, Devon County. But in actual fact, some of them are only for a few days or a week or so. But that's what the notice says. So the first one is Old Town Street, Dawlish. And that says from the 19th of February to the 15th of March. And it's Old Town Street, Dawlish, from the junction of Penfield Gardens, Clifton Place to junction of Weech Road. That's for gas mains replacement work. The next one is from the 11th of March to the 3rd of May, and this is Weech Road, Badlake Hill and Epsom's Hill, and that one again is for gas mains replacement. Brunswick Street, Tynmouth, that's from the 12th of March to the 18th of March. It's a suspension of four parking bays opposite Oliver Knapman, and there's no apparently alternative route, so tough luck. I think I go down that road as well to pick up a dog. There we go. The next one is from the 17th of February to the 15th of March, and it's the road from Idford Junction to Longthorn Cottage. and the road from Idford Junction to Alchard Junction, and road from Biddlecombe Cross to Idford Junction, Chudley and Idford. So I'm not quite sure what that's going to do. And that's to do with South West Water. So I think you just have to be aware that these things are going to happen.
And it'll
frustrate you. But maybe it's not as bad as that one. Where is it that there was going to be something like a 30-mile diversion because of one of the road closures? So, you know, I'm sure we should hopefully find our way around wherever we're trying to go.
This article is about the recycling in Tonbridge. The proportion of household waste sent for recycling in Tonbridge fell last year, new figures show. Environmental charity Keep Britain Tidy said a simpler recycling system is needed as England falls further and further behind its European neighbours. Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs figures show 48,000 tonnes of waste were collected in Tonbridge District Council in the last year up until March 2023. Of this, about 26,000 tonnes were sent for reuse, recycling or composting, meaning the area had a recycling rate of 53%. It was down from the year before when 55.6% of household waste was sent for recycling. Across England, the recycling rate also fell from 42% in 21-22 to 41.7% last year. All regions had decreases in their recycling rates, except for London, which saw no change. Alison Ogden Newton, OBE, Chief Executive of Great Keep Britain Tidy, said it is disappointing to see our recycling rates falling at a time when we should be doing more than ever to stop valuable materials being buried or burned. We are falling further and further behind some of our neighbours in Europe. In Germany, 71% of municipal waste is recycled, and Slovenia has seen a recycling rate of 22%. In Tonbridge, about 355.2 kilograms of household waste was recorded per person last year, down from 376 in the previous year to 60% in 21.
Thank you, Nev and Norma. Now I've got one letter from the paper. W. Cann of Tynmouth writes a letter headed "We Fight On." 2 months ago, Save Tynmouth Hospital Group were told at County Hall that their case for saving the hospital could be referred to the Secretary of State. 2 months later, nothing's been referred to the Secretary of State. Why? We soon found out. A Tynmouth doctor and a nurse persuaded the panel that their cause, a multi-million pound hub, was more essential than our hospital. The hub will be a workplace for doctors, some nurses, and a few clinics, but nowhere near the amount of clinics held at the hospital at present. I can't get my head around the fact that a doctor and a nurse can dismiss the fact that approximately 800 surgical procedures a year are carried out in the hospital. The doctors, we understand, own 2 Den Crescent, so why haven't they kept that in good repair? That, apparently, is why they need to move. I have to keep my own property in good state of repair. The nurse's contribution was patients had to manoeuvre 4 or 5 steps in the surgery. Well, I'm sure we have to climb stairs to the toilet many times. Can you believe that this is why they dismissed a Save the People's Hospital in favour of a costly hub? Unbelievable. On to this week's obituaries. The first one, James Lehman, known as Jim, passed away on the 3rd of February, aged 81. His funeral will be held on Thursday the 22nd of February at St Gregory's Church at 10:30 a.m, followed by a private burial. And there is to be a wake held at the Railway Inn. Any donations in his memory are to go to Alzheimer's Research. Kim Rennison passed away peacefully in Glendale Court on February the 3rd. The celebration of her life will take place at Torquay Crematorium on February the 27th at 1:30. Any donations for that one are to Parkinson's UK. Delfrin Williams, known as Del, died peacefully in his sleep, aged 91, on the 1st of February in Tynmouth. There are no funeral arrangements being made public for that one. And the last one, which has a major connection to our talking newspaper, Aileen Webster, who is the widow of Jonathan Webster, who was initially in charge of production for this paper, and Aileen has worked in the background for both Here and Now and Roundabout. She passed away peacefully at her home on January the 23rd, aged 78. Celebration of her life will take place at St George's Church, Holcombe, on February the 19th at 11 a.m. Any donations for that one are to Rowcroft. So now it's time to meet our next reader.
Hello, it's Fran Frank.
From Fran. So as I've already said, there is no Tynmouth headline article this morning, as it's the same as the Dawlish one. So over to Fran for her first report.
Right, my first one. A Tynmouth man will have to pay out £800 after failing to pay a £4.70 rail fare. That'll serve him right, won't it? John Bennett, 31, of Bunting Close, was found guilty in his absence, probably on the train still, at Plymouth Magistrates Court in the case brought by Great Western Railway. Bennett was accused of travelling at Newton Abbot Railway Station on November the 8th, 2023, without paying the fare and with the intention to avoid paying the fare. Magistrates found the case proved. Bennett was fined £440 and ordered to pay compensation of £4.70, a surcharge, to fund victim services of £176 and further costs of £180, making a total of £870. I think he should have thought before he got on the train.
Definitely. My first one is warning after rockfall. Walkers are being advised to avoid Ness Beach in Shoulden following a rockfall. The southern end of the beach has been affected by the fall. The cliffs are made of soft rock and are prone to erosion and landslips at any time. Teignbridge Council, which is responsible for the beach, has issued warnings. A spokesman said, please read the signs in the tunnel entrance to the beach and avoid the area under the cliffs. And there is a very spectacular picture of all these fallen rocks, and you would certainly have been in trouble if you'd happened to be in that spot when they came down. And there are two people just a little bit further along the beach, walking along oblivious to it. So,
isn't that there nice? We go. When you see the Jurassic coastline, they talk about not going near it, and people still walk along, don't they? Anyway, my next item is from the Bishop Stainton Probus Club. The Probus Club had an excellent and engaging presentation from their chairman, David Carpenter Clawson, a retired IT manager at the University of Exeter. His presentation gave an unexpected slant on social media, which provided an interesting perspective on the origins and use of social media. David accepted that social media, as we know it, is based on digital technologies, which started in the mid-1990s. But he gave an in-depth insight into ancient communication technology, which could be seen as the early roots of today's social media. For example, in Roman times, there were no printing presses, and letters were copied onto papyrus rolls, which, like modern social media, were shared with individuals, as well as some being posted in public for general consumption. That's if the people could read them, of course. Like our modern social media, the Roman system sometimes included rumour, gossip, or even untruths in a network of uncensored free speech. By the end of the 19th century, postal services were successfully providing news, communications, and the opportunity to share information and rumours.
The ease and speed was rapid, with mail delivered to houses as often as 12 times a day in London. Weren't they lucky we hardly get them once a week? Today, the pace, diversity, and dominance of social media platforms has gained widespread popularity, where in a world population of over 8 billion people, there are over 3 billion monthly active users on Facebook, including over half the entire UK population. David offered plenty of safety advice to users, reflected in his strong assertion that we should all be sensible and cautious about what information we share and when.
A musical fender bender. An evening of celebration for the world's most iconic guitar, the Fender Stratocaster, and the hits that defined its undeniable sound, takes to the stage of Pavilion's Tynmouth next week. Spanning the instrument's most important five decades, and featuring music from the likes of Bon Jovi, Dire Straits, Buddy Holly, The Shadows, Bryan Adams, Pink Floyd, and many more, 50 years of Fender in February, on February the 23rd, will have the dancers in the aisles and the guitar fans mesmerised. The unique two-hour show is presented by charismatic musicians, expert guitarists, and a phenomenal vocalist whose passion for the music and the instrument shines through in the stories of the iconic guitar and the performance of the music. Tickets for the 7:30 p.m. show can be booked from Pavilion's website.
And very good it will be. Right, Tynbridge District Council plan to raise council tax by 2.99%. Households in Tynbridge will pay an extra £5.70 on their annual council tax bills to fund local services. Tynbridge Council has almost completed its budget setting process for the year and plans to raise its charge by 2.99% as recommended by the government. Devon County Council adds more tax on top of that figure, as will town and parish councils, together with the fire and police authorities. The district council's share of the current council tax in Tynbridge is £190.71 per year for an average Band D property. The total bill will be £2,279.30 per property when other authority charges are added to this. This means that Tynbridge Council keeps just over 8% of the total bill, with Devon County Council getting 72%, police receiving 12%, fire receiving 4%, and local towns and parishes also receiving 4%. Tynbridge Executive Committee heard that a recent public consultation had found that 76% of the people who responded were in favour of the 2.99% increase. Councillor Richard Keeling, Lib Dem for Chudley, said the council's core priorities for the year ahead would be housing, climate change, and jobs. He went on to say, "This is what our community has been asking for."
Number of new social housing lets in Tynbridge hits decade low. The number of newly built social housing lets in Tynbridge has fallen to a decade low, new figures show. Homelessness and housing charity Crisis accused the government of political negligence and questioned how many more shameful records it needs to hit before it tackles the sheer lack of housing. Meanwhile, the Institute for Public Policy Research think tank said there is a desperate need to build more homes, especially affordable social housing. Housing Minister Michael Gove aims to implement a British Homes for British Workers policy, which will require people to provide a decade-long link to the UK and a two-year connection to the local area where the social housing they want is. Mr. Gove is also consulting on a law banning high earners from acquiring social housing, though the income level has not yet been determined. Department for Levelling Up Housing and Communities figures show 373 new social housing lets were offered to tenants in Teignbridge in 22-23. This was down from 388 in 21-22 and the lowest figure of any year over the past decade, with the number of new lets provided having fallen during that time. Across England, the number of new social housing lets provided fell by 6%, from 267,000 to 252,000, the lowest point in the past decade, excluding 2020-21. This covers all social housing, which is split into affordable or intermittent rent, and social rent. The former means a tenant pays 80% of market value, while the latter is set by the government and is paid to registered providers and local authorities and is significantly lower than the private market. Matt Downey, Chief Executive at Crisis, said, "How many more shameful records must we hit for the Westminster government to take the urgent action needed to tackle the chronic rise in homelessness and a sheer lack of housing?" He added, "This political negligence cannot continue. If we're going to address the mounting waiting lists for council housing and the record numbers trapped in hostels and B&Bs, then the Westminster government must build more social housing. We have the means to fix this, but only if we take the decisive action needed." Luke Murphy, Associate Director at the IPPR, said, "The government must invest and reform the planning system and the dysfunctional land market to tackle the housing crisis." Meanwhile, the number of new social rents across England, those that are the most affordable, has also plummeted across the last decade. It dropped by 7% to 209,000 in 22-23, and is now 40% lower than 10 years ago. In Teignbridge, this figure fell by more than a tenth during the same period, with 274 provided last year. A DLUHC spokesperson said, "We've delivered over 696,000 affordable homes since 2010, including 172,000 for social rent, and last year saw the highest levels of housing delivery on record, with a 17% increase in starts to the previous year. However, we know we need to build more affordable homes, which is why we're investing £11.5 billion to deliver more of the affordable quality homes this country needs."
My next article is actually a report from the manager of the Alice Cross Centre at Teignmouth. They attended the voluntary sector exhibition at Teignmouth Arts Action Group with 27 other organisations, and it was a great reminder of the breadth of wonderful charities that we have here in Teignmouth, working hard to offer the local community lots of opportunities. The sorts of things available to do are gardening, singing, photography, art classes, playing mahjong, acting courses, language, etc., music, film clubs to name but a few. So there really is something for everybody. Many organisations are also looking for volunteers, such as Action on Climate, Teen Heritage Centre, Teignmouth Library, the Orangery and the Teignmouth Coast Watch. Volunteering is very rewarding, and voluntary organisations rely on this support to deliver their services. One of our volunteer chefs said, "I still have a lot to give and would rather be doing something I love than sitting at home. I enjoy feeding people and supporting the charity and the rest of the team." Whether you want to get involved in a new hobby or volunteer your time, there will always be something for you here in Teignmouth. You can call us at the Alice if you want to find out more about what we offer, or any of the local charities can offer you. Events and activities for February here at the Alice Cross Centre include February the 18th, Stitch and, I'm not quite sure whether this is a misprint, but it says Bitch. Stitch and Bitch or Botch. Anyway, craft group. So let's say the stitching craft group. 6 to 8pm on February the 18th. £3, including refreshments. Bring your craft project to work on while you are here. A great group where the chat is always lively. February the 19th, air fryer basics course, 6 to 8pm, no charge. February the 21st, Sunday lunch from midday onwards, £10 for two courses, including tea or coffee. Booking essential though, it's obviously quite busy for its Sunday lunches. February the 26th, oh, another air fryer basics course, 6 to 8pm. March the 2nd, pre-loved sale, 9am to 12pm. A wide variety of bargains, including clothes, crafts and hobbies. Tables available for the sellers. £5 small table, £10 larger table. Weekly events include lunch on Monday, Thursday and Friday from midday, plus midweek roast every Wednesday from 12:15 until 1:30. £6 and £2 for a dessert if you've still got some room. Booking again essential. Table tennis is every Wednesday, 1:45. £2 per person. Includes refreshments. That's not bad value. Digital skills run every Wednesday from 2:30 to 4:30. If you need help with your new phone, laptop or tablet, we can help you set things up and the basics of using it. Again, they say booking essential, as long as you don't try booking on your phone. Saturday morning breakfast is from 9am to midday. Last orders, 11:30. Full English, £4, and a selection of hot and cold breakfasts. All events and any booking can be done through their website, thealicecross.co.uk, or ring 01626 778 039 and have a lovely time.
Do you have to take your own air fryer to the demonstrations?
Oh,
think about that.
No, good question.
I bet they haven't got more than one.
I doubt it.
Mm.
Right, so while the battle still goes on for Tynmouth Hospital, Torbay Hospital have got a new unit. New 15 million hospital day surgery unit to cut patient waiting times. A new £15 million operating theatre building has been opened at Torbay Hospital to help reduce surgery waiting times. The new building has two operating theatres and additional pre-operative assessment and recovery spaces. Hospital bosses say over time this will increase capacity to treat 4,500 more people each year. It is expected that one of the theatres will focus on breast and orthopaedic surgery, and this will help provide focus on day surgery, hip, knee and shoulder replacements across the organisation. The other will be used by the eye surgery team. Dr. Teresa Hind, Clinical Director of Day Surgery and Consultant Anaesthetist, I can't say that, at Torbay and South Devon NHS Foundation Trust, said, "We are so proud of our local, national and even international reputation for excellence in day surgery that has grown over the past 30 years. Around 85% of surgery at Torbay Hospital is undertaken as a day case, which we know has tremendous benefits for the people we care for, and we currently support around 12,000 people a year through the unit. I'm excited to see the benefits of these new facilities for both the experience of our patients and the staff who work in them. The number of people we support will increase over time once the theatres become fully operational, which will help reduce waiting limits, lists, I think that should say, it's not what it says, but there we go, but more importantly, help us treat local people sooner. The new facilities provide a more comfortable space for people having an operation and will enhance the working environment for staff."
My last article at the moment comes from the arts section. Alid Jones is a singer who's been ever present in our lives for more than 40 years. From boy treble to broadcaster and then radio presenter, he's the ultimate classical crossover star. And next month, he celebrates over 40 years in the business with a UK-wide tour, which is set to visit Palace Theatre in Paignton on March the 31st. Here, ahead of the celebratory show called Full Circle, he looks back at his remarkable career. He was the boy trouble who captivated the world with his angelic voice. Selling over 7 million albums, his recording from the animated film The Snowman firmly established him as a household name, and he has become an integral part of the nation's festivities. But Alid's achieved that rarest of feats. He somehow managed to sustain a level of success across four decades. There are plenty who enjoy fame as kids or as stars on talent shows, but they're frequently here today and gone tomorrow. Alid has broken that mould. Having enjoyed a remarkable 4 years as a kid, during which he became the most interviewed guest on TV's Wogan talk show, forming a close bond with the BBC presenter, he then forged a new career. He became a star in the West End, in Andrew Lloyd Webber's Joseph, while teaming up with Lorraine as co-host in ITV's Daybreak. I've always felt lucky having the career I have, but as I get older, I feel that I am so honoured to be living this life, he said. I love what I do for a living. I have been so fortunate to be part of people's lives for so many years. In fact, I feel almost tearful when I think about it. The fun part came when he was hanging out with royalty and singing in the Royal Albert Hall year after year. It felt like being the heavyweight boxing champion of the world, and until you get knocked out, it's great. I knew that my boyhood was to be short-lived, but for those few years, I crammed in as much as I could. Maximum singing and maximum fun. The fun bit was down to my mum and dad. When I was back at school, it was interesting to say the least. His relationship with the royal family has endured over many years. He shared the same hairdresser as Princess Diana and was invited... Stop laughing. And he was invited to sing for Charles and Diana while still a boy. The highlight was the private performance for Prince Charles and Princess Diana in their home in Kensington Palace. The palace apparently rang my dad at work, and my dad put the phone down thinking it was someone from work playing a practical joke. Then an equerry rang back and said the call was real. Prince Charles apparently loved my voice and wanted to hear me sing before my voice broke. How would Thursday evening be? My dad apparently said, yes, that's fine. So off I went from North Wales with my mum and my pianist, and I arrived at Kensington Palace. We knew the butler well because he was a friend of my great uncle. Interesting small world. And I remember sitting in their private front room in Kensington Palace. I sat on one sofa and my accompanist from North Wales, Annette Paree, who'd never been to London, much less Kensington Palace, sat on the other sofa, with my mother also stood in the room. We waited in silence until the prince entered. Mrs. Jones, or can I call you Nest? He said, what would you like to drink? And I could see my mum thinking, does he mean water, coffee or tea? It was as though time had stood still. And then he placed a hand on her knee and said, you'll join me in a gin and tonic. And she breathed out a sigh of relief and said, oh, yes, please. Diana apparently then came bounding in after that. She'd got wet hair because she'd been swimming. Actually, I knew her quite well by then, so we had a hug. I sang for an hour, whatever songs they wanted. And then there was the performance at the celebrity wedding of the year when Bob Geldof married Paula Yates and rock royalty descended. Allard was photographed next to David Bowie before following the members of Spandau Ballet around for the day, in case they wanted him to join them. The wedding was utterly beautiful. I remember standing with Bob before he went into the church. He wanted everything to be just perfect. I sang my songs, and I remember looking into the congregation and seeing a sea of famous faces, all smiling. After the service, I was sitting by the organ, and I remember Simon Le Bon, who was best man, coming up to me and saying, "I loved your singing, but more than anything, I love your socks." Oh well, it's amazing what these stars notice. Let me tell you about my socks. At my school, at the time, there was a fad for wearing luminous socks, one orange and one green, and I wore those for the wedding. What was I thinking? Simon led me upstairs to the house where about 20 of the guests were gathered for the official photo. I was able to go and stand behind a big chair. And so I was born on one of the most iconic wedding photos ever. I had no idea at the time that the man sitting in front of me, whose shoulder I had my hand on, was the one and only David Bowie. I couldn't take it all in. Bob Geldof suggested we all went out to play baseball or rounders. It was Paula's team versus Bob's team. I was on Bob's, if I remember correctly. There were pop A-listers playing rounders in their tuxedos. The light started to fade and I heard Bob shout, "Take off your socks!" And we all put one of my luminous socks on the ball so that we could still see it as it started to get dark. It was very surreal. Then there was a massive firework display and a free bar. I hope he didn't join in, he was a child. With the party going on into the early hours, as you can imagine, the live band at the party was out of this world. Duran Duran, Spandau Ballet, Lulu, all sharing the mic. I didn't join them. It was incredible. My dad was an engineer at the time and my mum was a primary school teacher. And there we were, the three of us, rubbing shoulders with a load of celebrities. My parents had the time of their lives because it was so incredible. It was the most extravagant and spectacular thing I'd ever witnessed. Bob and Paula were so kind to me that day, and at subsequent meetings, I was honoured to sing on their big day, and they remembered it. He apparently at another time sang for Leonard Bernstein, a man he likens to Mozart, and became great friends with Judy Dench. He also played alongside Julie Andrews and won an Ivor Novello, an Emmy, and an MBE, although he admits that he can't remember where they are at the moment. Then he became one of the nation's best and most loved interviewers and presenters, so much so that Michael Parkinson told him there was nobody else better, apart from himself. One of the best moments was working with Julie Andrews, apparently. There's a video of Julie Andrews and me singing Edelweiss, and at the end we put our heads together and she gave me a kiss. That was probably the most overwhelming thing I've ever done. For me, she's one of the greatest, if not the greatest, film stars of my generation. Growing up, I loved the Mary Poppins or The Sound of Music. She was a brilliant actress with a subliminal voice. To get the invitation to interview Julie Andrews on her tour was just a dream come true, and he still regards it as a pinch-me moment. Julie was so lovely to me, she wrote me a handwritten letter at the end of the tour. I have it framed in my office, unlike the awards he's lost, you know. Sorry. Working with her is one of the highlights of my career. It wasn't just that we performed together on stage, it was also the time we spent backstage, where we were as thick as thieves. She had a wonderful team around her of genuine people who'd been around with her for years, and for them to allow me to get into that inner sanctum was very special. I was completely transported. I was singing Edelweiss with Dame Julie Andrews. It doesn't get any better than that. It was supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Thank you, Alad.
Thank you, Fran. That was absolutely brilliant, and I don't think we can follow that, so we won't. We are now coming to the end of this week's edition of Here and Now, recorded at our studio in Dawlish on Friday the 16th of February 2024. We hope you've enjoyed the programme, which was brought to you by the Blue Team. Our readers have been Nev Pope, Norma Orty, Fran Frank, and me. Copy and Dispatch has been Fran Frank. Programme was produced by Chris Wall here in Dawlish, and I'm Mo Hutchings, the team leader. The next Here and Now recording will be on Friday the 23rd of February, when it will be the turn for the Red Team to bring you the week's news. So now the Blue Team send our very best wishes. Happy birthday if you're celebrating this week. Keep safe and well. And so now it's goodbye from all the team.
Goodbye.